good. I think we'll get awkwardly close here. We'll try to avert each other's gaze.
At least you have a good view.
Yeah. Welcome, everyone, to the Patitude Podcast. I am none other than Pat Parnell, and it is always good to sit down, have a drink, and find some conversation. And today's guest is none other than Pierce Kukizi, former Army Ranger, and I'd say purveyor of all things fun, and I don't know.
Trying to be.
Yeah, you're, gosh, when as people will get to find out today, you do kind of everything. And anything that probably moves the needle when it comes to adrenaline and fear-based. Safe assessment?
Definitely.
Okay,
we're going to be a jack of all trades and master it, hopefully.
So we're gonna cover a lot of ground, everything from tequila to time in the military to anything in all sports and things that you learned through that. I want to start with kind of your, I would say not humble, but innocent beginnings, because I want to know how one... We're going to get there in the conversation of how you ended up in the Army Rangers, but like, how does one start with water polo and rugby and kind of find its way to the military?
Yeah. So I guess the path is interesting because I had nobody who really showed me the way. Everybody who served in my family in the military was all my grandparents' generation. So I was very far removed. They didn't talk about it too much.
I mean, did you have an opinion on it when you were younger? Because I mean,
I always thought it was cool, but when I saw conventional military, it didn't appeal to me. I guess I've kind of always been, typical a lot of action sports athletes wanting to go against the rules, almost like a outlaw kid kind of way, right? So when I was younger, it didn't appeal to me the way it did to my brother. So I went more into the action and extreme sports. Honestly, if my mom had it the right way, I'd probably be playing golf and chess. And I was always seeking out the most kind of violent sports.
And help us understand the setting. This is East Coast, New York?
East Coast, New York, Connecticut border, right near the water.
Okay.
Yeah, so I grew up playing all the, typical soccer, baseball, everything like that. And then started to see these other sports that weren't mainstream, but actually had a good community where I lived. First one was water polo. And I think I learned quickly that I really liked the physicality of it.
Now, there's some dirty shit going on in the water. Seriously dirty shit going on in water polo.
Yeah, essentially wrestling and drowning each other. I loved that, and I found kind of strength as a kid, developed semi-quickly. And then into high school, I saw rugby as well, and it was really the same thing. Really impressive guys physically, a big team sport, getting able to hit each other and run around the field.
I find rugby such a superior game. I don't know if you ever had the chance to go to an All Blacks game or Springboks, but it's what a lot of people don't understand about rugby is there's something for everyone in that game.
Yes.
Versus, I think, American football. I mean, you watch a typical NFL game, you're seeing maybe 8 to 9 minutes of actual play time.
Yeah,
you look at rugby, it is full on nonstop. I mean, your ears came out okay. You got cauliflower ear.
I would tape them down.
Okay. Yeah, the scrums are vicious, right? So yeah, so that's an interesting mix right there, just in itself, that you did water polo and rugby.
Yeah, I started rugby because I wanted to get into more physical sports. I thought it would be a good fit. Some of my friends were playing it, and then I completely fell in love with the game and the culture of rugby. I mean, in no other sport, you really can't have that one outstanding player. There are plays in rugby where the team literally locks together as one unit and moves the ball across the try line, which is like a touchdown in football. And then it's always a tradition where you party with the other team afterwards. So
yeah,
it's a pretty awesome sport.
Yeah, I mean, straight rugby, Australian league rules, all of it, I find it superior. But we can sideshelf that. So I want to get into, if you're doing these more, say, water polo, rugby, how and where did you find everything from skateboarding to, was it BMX initially or mountain biking or?
It was skateboarding was big just because my area, mountain biking, surfing, skiing.
Yeah. Where are you surfing? Rockaway? Are you going up to Montauk?
Yeah,
are you going
to Long Beach.
Okay.
Long Beach, Long Island.
Like dedicated to the point where you're in a 5 mil? What, like wintertime?
I've done it, but not. I wish more. A little bit more difficult to get to. I ended up just going more towards the skiing in the winter. And then the motorsports and the aerial stuff kind of came later, more towards college. But yeah, I guess I was always looking for the extreme. I always liked the challenge. I loved being in nature. And it was really, that was my outlet.
Okay. So take us through, what did the military switch, or that kind of like that epiphany, something that you wanted to serve, you wanted to do your part. Did it happen pre-college or before? I mean, pre-college or after?
So pre-college, I had the notion of, I don't really know where my place is. I don't think I fit in into kind of the typical college and corporate track after. And I felt pretty lost in high school and early college.
That's good to hear. Because I mean, like, looking at your resume, I'm like, damn. It's like, it sounds like you just kind of went through and you just started checking things off. But it's good to hear that you were a little lost.
And the resume looks great,
yeah,
to be honest. And, yeah, it always
You can toot your own horn here. It's okay.
Right? But that was a learned skill. But it wasn't necessarily, you know, how I felt on the inside. I felt, honestly, maybe all of those steps were so I could be doing things to help me find a certain way. But I never really did. I just felt more and more lost. I then, during college, started either reading books or seeing about them and talking to these guys. I learned about special operations. I learned about SEALs, Rangers, Green Berets, pararescue jumpers. And I was hooked. It was, the feeling that I got wasn't even, that's what I want to do. It was, that is me. These are the guys who I am. I finally found like what somebody like me goes and does when they want to give back and serve and continue putting all these extreme activities that I was doing, but kind of for nothing, into a purposeful way.
Well, I mean, I think when people look at military, they definitely, you know, when you, you know, Delta Force, Army Rangers, what's the other of the three?
Green Beret.
Green Beret. Okay. Look at that. Wow. Boom. I actually got it.
Pretty good.
No, but it's, you know, that's the one thing that people look at, and it's glamorized, but you also then have to understand, well, I might not be able to get there, right?
Yeah.
You can't just assume that, oh, that's what I want to do, I'm going to do it, right? There's a lot of hoops to go through.
This was the biggest risk I've by far ever taken, because I signed a contract that locked me into the military for a certain number of years, whether I made it to where I wanted to go or not. I had a very clear view. I wanted to be serving in the 75th Ranger Regiment, which is part of the U.S. Army Special Operations Command, but there was no guarantee. I could have failed at any point along the way and then been stuck at a job that I possibly could have hated in the place I didn't want to be.
Was there any, early on, when you're getting close to that goal of becoming, you know, in the Rangers, was there any point of doubt where you're like, okay, I don't know if I can do this? Was it?
So I did my research pretty diligently. I spent a lot of time before I entered the military talking to people, getting as much information as you can to a system where, you know, you really have no eye to the inside. I sort of made a mental switch before I entered was, I'm not going in this to try to be a Ranger. I already am a Ranger. I just haven't done the steps to get there yet.
Well, an internal Jedi mindfuck.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, okay. it sounds really arrogant, but I think it was needed, because you go through this system that completely exposes how your mind works in a normal fashion, which is everything is uncertain. I don't know what my future is. Yeah. And then all of your mind goes, okay, well, what about quitting? Well, can you do this? You're not good enough. These are all normal things that your brain's telling you for survival.
Which we're going to go into detail and unpack a lot of that, because I know with when it comes to your coaching and what you're doing now that it's been a year since you've been a Ranger, and you've been working with a lot of different people. But I definitely want to dive into that. And another thing that's kind of I'm a little blown away with is how young you are, and you have kind of the self-presence of realizing that that's what's going on. You're conscious of what your mind is doing and you're thinking about. Were you like that from an early age, or was it something you kind of developed with having to put yourself in challenging situations?
It's tough to say. I mean, I think the military experience definitely accelerated that growth, because I was put in essentially the most stressful environment you can be in. When I was younger, I definitely sought out mental challenges, but looking back, I realized that I didn't deal with them as well. And it's interesting, I started to gain the awareness more when I was going through the selection pipeline, where guys to the right and left of me, when we, you know, stood every morning to show that we were there, were far better athletes than I was. I mean, I played college rugby, was a club system, and I had guys that had gone to Olympic trials. One guy had played professional lacrosse, and these guys were much, they were bigger, stronger, faster, everything. And one day, they just didn't show up. And I realized that you could hear it in their, the conversations to themselves in the days before. They basically succumbed to their own, the thoughts of quitting in their mind. And it's there for everybody. Like, I'm no different, no Superman.
Is it, is there part of that that you, you feel that you get kind of a buzz, a kickback from not quitting? Like,
it was more understanding that the process was really painful physically, mentally, but the pain I would have felt for eternity of quitting.
The alternative was worse than,
I was going to either make it or something on my body was going to be broken.
So what's the biggest misnomer that people, when we see, you know, Army Rangers in the movies, what's the biggest misnomer that people just don't understand? Like, you know, we see the movies, how it's portrayed, but what do we need to know?
You know, it's that all the guys are basically normal, you know, normal people that you went to high school with, you played sports with, but they were just able to make a different switch to put themselves into those situations. And the other part of it is that, you know, unfortunately, it would be nice, but unlike, you know, a lot of professional players that can just walk out onto the field and play, we do everything. So that means take care of the equipment, sweep the locker room, make all the travel plans, sign up for, it's a, there's a lot that goes on into the job. We're all kind of all the parts of the team.
And how many tours did you go on?
So I was in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. My unit has deployed 4 months a year, every year since 2001.
Good Lord.
So we have a pretty high deployment rate and a lot of experience.
I don't even know what I'd... The fact that you've been to all three different theaters does one kind of resonate a little more raw than another?
All of them were different. I would say in Iraq and Syria, I spent the time doing your typical special operations mission set, which is we stay at our base, we go out at night, we come back. Right, we're always out there in the darkness. Mm-hmm. Come back before the sunrise. You know, land the helicopters right on the enemy compound or over in the next valley, and maybe, you know, drive dune buggies in and then come out. In Syria, it was a little different. We had no major establishment there. A lot of the invasions in Raqqa and that area were pretty new. And so I really got to be sort of on the ground in the city, seeing it. There was no big helicopters. There was no drones watching overhead. It was four guys and two trucks. And that place left a pretty good impact on me. I got to see sort of the, interact with a lot of the kids, interact with locals in their cities, in day-to-day life, as war's going on.
Was it easier? I don't even know how to, by the way, I don't even know how to turn this my alerts on my, hopefully, and I, cause I turned my phone off, but I'm still getting it now on my, anyhow, we'll just deal with that. Is it, when you talk about being around the children and the people in the villages, what do we need to understand about, you know, winning the hearts and minds, in those kind of situations?
Hearts and minds is difficult because we're essentially complete outsiders coming in and inflicting change, and whatever you see that as negative or positive. Some people there absolutely love us. Some people there absolutely hate us.
No matter what you do and how you act.
What we do. But what I learned was more human nature, which left a huge impact on me. So in the area I grew up in, we had every economic status within a 10-minute drive. I had, you know, projects, housing, middle class, and mansions on the water. And seeing how the happiness level of children where I grew up with, no matter what they had, and then children who had nothing but a rock to play with and one shoe, who showed up every day to where we were living, smiling and happy, made me think, wow, maybe maybe it's not the external things we have. Like, how are these people so content and happy, or seemingly so content and happy in their situation? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't see a lot of that from people here. So as a perspective change for me, it was incredible. And I wish more people could see that without having to go into a war zone. But it took a lot away from that experience.
When did the talent of being quite the sharpshooter, how did that formulate? I hear you got a good, you got some good aim. is that a safe assessment?
Decent shot.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people, competition shooters, that are far better. Right? We train, we have so many tools in the tool bag that sometimes shooting goes to the wayside, and a lot of it is just tactics.
Yeah.
But I didn't shoot guns before I entered the military, barely. Maybe I'd done it more than twice. And then it's just pushed heavily. And the higher up the chain you go, once you get into special operations, you know, the budget we have for training and ammunition is exponential compared to, you know, what you think of as regular military.
Yeah, so I do want to get into that in terms of, you know, I know you have a passion for shooting, and it's another thing, much like the military, I think people have a hard time kind of wrapping their heads around. Just, it's so politicized with guns, and there's the military component, and then there's, you know, the amendment component here, and depending where you sit in the country. But talk about just the upside and kind of the connection and the passion you can have for shooting, and, you know, for the, whether it be a pastime or whether it be, you know, for protection.
Yeah, so there's tons of different sides to shooting. The shooting part that I enjoy the most is just, I consider it a sport. It's in a controlled environment. Okay. It's no different than archery or surfing, right? It gives me essentially the same type of, I can train.
Yeah, just full disclosure, I've done it. One of the guilty pleasures we've always done, like when we'll be over the North Shore during Triple Crown, and maybe like a blown out day, we'll go to Waikiki, we'll go longboarding. Probably wouldn't recommend this, but, you know, we get drunk on Mai Tais at Duke's, and then we go to the gun clubs in Waikiki, and, you know, you get to shoot the Dirty Harry gun, you get to shoot all the different AR-15, like all the different guns, but in a controlled environment. Very, very, you know, safe, and trying to teach you the proper way to handle a weapon.
I think is important.
Yeah.
So I teach some courses as well with a company called Defense Strategies Group, started by my buddy Mike O'Dowd, who's a former SEAL. And the training there is really to take, you know, whether you believe people in the U.S. should have guns or not is besides the point. There are good citizens out there who choose to own weapons, and unfortunately, they really have no idea what they're doing with them, which puts their family, themselves, and everybody else at risk. So what we do is we take them out to the range, and we essentially, you know, teach them our way. So we're creating confidence with their weapons and competence in decision-making and how to use it, right? So that they can feel comfortable with a weapon, just as most people feel comfortable with a kitchen knife or a car, which technically could be deadly weapons as well.
I was hoping that you were going to say you took them out to the open range, dropped them off, and see how long they could last.
But we'll be doing a little bit of that too.
Yeah, that's a reality show in itself. So how about, you know, because I know a lot of the components, at least what I've heard that you kind of utilize in your coaching are things that you kind of pulled from your experiences, whether when you, all these different deployments, right? There's the fear component. There's the, you know, the risk involved. There's the focus needed in those kind of heated moments. Maybe you could talk about how you developed the mental weaponry, if you will.
So most of what we do is I take the, and this really applies to anything. It's not just shooting. This could be surfing, motorcycle riding, business. Right? I'm taking really basic skills. So in shooting, it's pointing a gun at a target, pulling the trigger. Mechanically, really simple. Everybody in an easy environment with no pressure should be able to learn that pretty simply. Then we take kind of decision-making components of, let's say we have a scenario where you're going to save somebody, or you're moving around barricades or through a city. And then we put those all together under stress. And that's what I learned from the military, is that it does not matter how well you train these basic components, just like an athlete, if you can't perform it under pressure, or in our case, with somebody else shooting at you, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So what we do is we create, now I can't recreate somebody shooting at you, or I can't recreate somebody breaking into your house or trying to steal your kid on the street. Emotionally, I can't recreate that. But by utilizing tools such as we'll run around with a 100-pound sandbag, we'll throw medicine balls and then shoot, sprint up hills. So I'm creating the same internal environment of stress, which is heart rate up, blood pressure up, adrenaline, all these other chemicals. Your breathing patterns change. I'm physically recreating the same thing. So now you have to perform under stress. And that opens, usually blows people's minds and opens it up of, wow, I can't perform these basic tasks. What goes first? Fine motor skills. Oh man, what goes next? I mentally either want to quit or can't handle it. So then we teach techniques to sort of bring the nervous system back down, such as breath work, other ways to kind of move through a stress course. So these people can learn to deal with, you know, physical stress and mental, emotional stress and like anxiety as they're doing this. Yeah. I think it translates into everything.
I love that you brought up breath. I mean, there's such a hype on, even beyond Wim Hof, and but James Nestor, his recent book, Breath. Is this something that you're intrigued by and that you implement? Yeah.
And I implemented it in the military when we would run these stress courses. I would sort of track like where I could get my heart rate to if I was breathing just nasally versus through the mouth, and extended exhales versus inhales.
Note to everyone, don't be a mouth breather, right?
And what's funny is I didn't, and mouth breather is a term that is used constantly.
You've heard it, right? Yeah, you just didn't realize it's actually as bad as it's supposed to sound.
And the people that were saying it, like, oh, he's a mouth breather, also didn't understand.
Right.
They thought, you know, it just looks stupid when you have your mouth hanging open. And then I started to learn the science of it, and just like in James Nestor's book, there's so much. And I started to realize that it was affecting my physiology. And then I started to realize after the military how it affects every situation, socially, with the family, with business, that breath is like an incredible tool.
On top of the breath, I heard you talking about, like, you know, trying to put these, putting people into situations that are not easy by design. And it reminds me a little bit of Joe DeSena and, you know, what he did with Spartan Racing. I mentioned obstacle immunity. It's like there's this, like what they call it, the suffer fest. What do you think it is about the rise in popularity of everyone wanting to put themselves in pain? Is it like this rise of masochism, right?
Yeah, well, I think humans innately have a drive to sort of prove themselves, and there's also an exploration of what can I accomplish.
Yeah.
Right. And that's not just in the physical, that's with everything, with business, filmmaking, sports, whatever it is. And people want to push themselves. And after high school and college, and people lose the sports and camaraderie, I think they seek out other challenges. A lot of people don't feel fulfilled unless they can go seek out goals and challenges, a reason why a lot of people join the military.
Because, I mean, you talk about, what you get from that team component when you leave team sports and you get older. And if you're not in, say, action sports and you're going off and you're doing big toe-ins at Jaws or whatever, you really don't have that fear bonding, right? You need something to have fear bonding with other groups of people, right? And that's kind of what it sounds like you experienced when, I would imagine you have to experience that, whether it be Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq. To say the least, what I think fear bonding is on a steep pal run that we hike to, like in the Tetons, that doesn't even come close to compare what you went through.
But that's big too, and it's all I've also realized that everything is just perspective. So it doesn't matter if it was your first time on the bunny slope, or you know, a huge backcountry run, or in war in Afghanistan. Right, those are all our biggest fear experiences in which we got to bond with people. And I think a lot of people miss that, and they really miss tight bonds. And I think it's thrown in everybody's face now, especially with pandemic and quarantine, they realized how that not only affects their mental state, their physical state as well.
Do you feel, you know, I mentioned obstacle immunity. It's a term that's thrown around a lot in OCR, is that you do something that's really difficult, like really hard. Say you do an ultra or a beast, or even if it's like a sprint, like an 11 mile, make it through most of the obstacle courses or the obstacles, very few burpees. but a week later, you're sitting in traffic. They say, you know, you're like just losing your mind. Your mind automatically goes there where, you know what? I just did a fucking 11 mile race in the cold rain. I'm like, I can handle this, right? Isn't that what it's part of the weaponry that it gives you, that to handle the stuff that you allegedly think is difficult, but it's really not?
Only if you can become aware of how you react to that traffic situation. So, for example, I think special operations military guys, we use the term stress inoculation. The same thing, obstacle immunity, right? Just another way of massive exposure.
I'm going to TM that. That's really, I love that. I love stress inoculation.
Massive exposure.
Way cooler than COVID vaccine, yeah. Yeah.
Right? And the highest ability to deal with that and to deal with crazy things, right? But if we don't learn how to come back down, then if my brain gets used to how I deal with stress in a combat situation and how high it's sort of ramped up and, you know, pedal to the floor, if I take that same mentality down to traffic, won't be able to deal with just traffic. And guys are realizing that, how, you know, anger issues and flipping out.
So what's the keys to compartmentalize? Like, how do you, that's got to be the most difficult thing. And I'm sure a lot of your fellow Rangers too, right? Not everyone handles it equally.
Well, the issue is we have a fantastic ability to compartmentalize emotion in difficult scenarios. Like if your buddy gets shot, you still have to complete the mission so that he can eventually get home safe. And if we disconnect from the emotions too much, that's where you get to substance abuse and other self-destructive behaviors. So it's important to recognize that all of the tools that we learned in those stressful situations can also be applied to sitting in traffic, dealing with your wife or your kids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But a lot of people, it takes a lot to realize that because we've lived at such a, you know, high rate of speed for so long.
So would this actually, that perfectly kind of segs into, you're used to this, you know, constant, like just pumping of endorphins. You leave the military. So would you say now you're more inclined to go chasing things like speed flying and, you know, on your bike, you know, MotoGP style, getting low, whether it be skiing, whether it be skateboarding? Do you find yourself now chasing that rush a little bit differently, or is it
for a different purpose and a different reason? So when I first came out of the military and life slows down in an instant, I needed it essentially as a fix. And that was what was calming my mind down. Mm-hmm. And I was having trouble mentally if I wasn't engaging in those sports. I have been able to, over the last year, change that and see it as an opportunity to improve, an opportunity for adventure. I'm doing them just the same amount, just with a little bit different mindset. And it's been cool. Now I've also been able to introduce other people into these sports too, which is even more fulfilling, I think, than doing it myself.
So I would assume, you know, you got comfortable in the air with a chute on your back via the military, right? It takes a while. A lot of people, I'm so envious of, you know, low proximity flying and speed flying. And I mean, explain to the people, like people listening, you know, what we're talking about here. Cause it's intense.
the proximity stuff is far more intense, and I haven't done wingsuits, but I do speed flying, which is essentially taking a really small paraglider, running or skiing off a mountain, and the goal is to fly as close to the ground as you can, because the closer to the ground you are, the more perception of speed. It's riskier and way more fun.
It's insanely risky. I don't know if you were at Red Bull the time that I... Nick Nolte did like the initial voiceover for this speed flying in Europe, but he didn't finish. So they brought me in and I voiced it, And by the time it was a three-part series, by the time the third episode finished, like two of the like five guys had passed away doing this. So there is risk involved.
And unfortunately, one of the guys that taught me passed away as well. Yeah. So there's a massive inherent risk. So I realize that the risk of that sport. So I try not to push it too hard, and I kind of know my limits. I think I'm very calculated, but there's a risk with everything.
Right.
So, but yeah, it's definitely different than skydiving. There's no reserve chute or anything like that.
It's definitely in a class of its own. I remember the first time I saw wingsuiting, he's since passed away, but it was Dean Potter, and we were in Lauterbrunnen in Switzerland, and we were doing a feature on him. And I'll never forget, we were taking the tram up and we got off to do some interview along the way. And Dean was like, "Pat, look at this rock way over there." And I could just see these two little dots. And he's like, "Now watch these guys." And they jumped off, and they were like miles away from us. And sure enough, like within, I don't know, like a minute and a half, these guys come flying by, and it sounded like two DC-10s flying overhead. They're like 40 feet, 60 feet just above us. And then boom, all the way into the valley, like towards Grindelwald. I was like, you gotta be effing kidding me. I'm like, and with the wingsuits, but the sound and the energy. And I mean, you guys are so lucky that you get to experience that, just that feeling.
Yeah. I've walked through Lauterbrunnen to see them as well.
Yeah.
I used to watch videos of the wingsuiters all through my childhood and completely enamored by it. But yeah, the dream of flight, I feel like is one for most people.
Jeb lives up in Santa Monica, Jeb Corliss. Yeah. I've hung out with him, and he's, I think everyone loves to kind of just, oh yeah, you know, this person's got a screw loose. I'm like, no, it's just, he does have a weird connection with fear and like death and animals. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, like truly calculated, really, really thinks stuff through.
And I think a lot of people have that, especially in the sport like that, where you need to.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of room for error.
So, okay. So speed flying aside, you still get enjoyment from, I know you said, you mentioned you're going to Park City next week, like just doing the basic fun stuff, right? You don't need to be hucking off a 40-foot cliff or.
I've sort of tried to realize it now and bring my own.
Sustainable. You want to remain sustainable. Right.
I'm going for longevity here, but yeah, I still absolutely love being in raw, wild nature and, I'll still push it a bit to have fun on these sports.
I want to just rewind a little bit because we got a little sidetrack, and that's okay when you're doing just sit downs. And I am, by the way, I will say I'm a little upset you didn't bring tequila. Because I know that you're part owner in a tequila company, right?
I am a friendly investor in Nosotros Tequila.
Okay. Who does that? Who comes in an interview and doesn't bring tequila?
I really should have done that. I could have stuffed it in my motorcycle jacket. I'll make sure for next time.
Okay, so I digress, but I wanted to kind of bring it back to the coaching that you're doing. You talked about how you're trying to recreate certain things, but what are some like simple takeaways that maybe you can offer the listeners today? Just like little things, like little crutches that you find helpful on a day to day, whether it be like a way to approach affirmation or to actualize things differently.
Yeah, so a lot of the things I sort of got on this coaching path as I came out of the military. I started mentoring guys that wanted to go into special operations. I started to get a ton of questions from people, questions from athletes, questions from friends, and realized that a lot of the things that I used could translate directly. And a lot of the things that people asked me were different from what I would tell them. The question was always, how do I prepare physically? How do I prepare physically? And I would always say, you know, it's the mental part that everybody misses. The physical is just a baseline. For everyday life, one of the biggest things is the recognition that you are not your thoughts, right? Your mind runs on its own. You don't choose to dream in the middle of the night. You don't choose to wake up and worry about your work day. Like, those things are built in there as a survival mechanism to help you. We live in a little bit of a different world. And typically, your mind is always, the future is very uncertain, right? And I learned this in the military, of going to a mission where I basically had no idea of knowing what was going to happen. And so your brain, for survival, plans for uncertainty and tries to come up with certain outcomes based on what has happened in the past. Usually they're negative so that you can prepare for them. So people are running around all day thinking, why am I having all these negative thoughts, and thinking it's really them. If we can just recognize that the thoughts of quitting a project you started, lack of motivation to do things, or lack of wanting to take risks, are all built in there, and you're not alone in those feelings. Everybody has them. If you recognize that, then you can go forward and change, right? So everything, when I was even in just making the decision to go into the military, my mind is always like, do you want to take that risk? Is this really what you're going to do? Or are you going to be happy? It's just going, going, going until you sort of take control. And a lot of the physical ways I learned to take control were the breath work, slowing my breathing down, which slows your mind down, visualization. So if my mind starts getting crazy, or if, you know, people want to hear the military example, if I'm in a helicopter in the middle of the night, 60 feet above the rooftop of a building, and I have to slide down a rope to get there, everybody, no matter how many times you've done it, his mind is going to go, oh shit, what if this goes wrong?
Right.
What's going to happen? What could possibly happen on the way down?
Everything's fine until it's not.
And you physically change. When you start getting stressed out, you lose that calm person that has all the skills to execute it perfectly. Yeah. So we have to calm ourselves down. The other tool is visualization. So whether you're going into an interview, you're going into a tryout, you're going into talking to a new girl on the street, right? It could be visualizing and using performance-oriented thoughts all the way up until you actually have to perform the task. And then you can kind of do it mindlessly.
I mean, a lot of this sounds very Eastern philosophy, very kind of, you know, there's a woo-woo factor of it.
There is.
And is, so do you get any pushback from guys that are a little bit more, say, myopic in their approach to problem solving, you know, where they're like, oh, that sounds like meditation. I'm not going to do that.
Well, I was that guy.
Yeah, you were.
So now and I realize that not everybody will be in that stage. And so I was the one that didn't do yoga and then had trouble tying my boots in Syria because that's such a big problem. I was the one that didn't do the breath work, didn't do the meditation. And then, you know, my mind was running crazy on seemingly meaningless tasks like sitting in traffic or dealing with something.
Was there one moment where you tried it and you had that aha? You're like, holy shit, this works. This actually impacts the way my body is handling physically and mentally if I follow this.
I realized it first when I was training. So in, let's say, practicing for a stress shoot, or, you know, doing training missions, and I realized that the breathing techniques and the visualizations made a huge change.
Yeah.
Then I saw other guys that were not using it and their lack of performance. The biggest switch was when I started using it in my everyday life post-military, and I realized how it affected everything else.
Yeah, and it's pretty amazing too now that we have the technology to see the metrics. You know, you always hear about someone in a biathlon and, you know, coming off the skis and then slowing has this ability to slow his heart rate down, which you have to, if you're going to be, whether it be a sniper or just sharp shooting, like you have to be able to do that. You're not going to be able to perform if you can't slow your shit down. Right.
Yeah, what's cool about it now is there is the science. So I can go up to somebody and talk about breath, you know, they could be the big badass warrior or athlete, and I can talk about breath work that sounds woo woo. I also have data that I could back it up. We could go out with a heart rate monitor and I could literally show them their performance in relation to their heart rate and the time it takes to lower it to the level that they need to. So luckily now it's sort of mainstream enough.
It's interesting too, you know, we brought up James Nestor in his book Breath. He was also, before his book Deep, was complete skeptic, you know, just did not want to be taken down that path. And I love that you say that, yeah, I came from a skeptic corner. You know, I had my ways of doing stuff, and you're probably fairly successful to get where you were at that time.
Yeah.
But to get to the point where you're truly, you know, just succeeding on a way different level, these are the keys that you need to use, right?
Absolutely. And I think sort of the life progression makes you realize things more and more as well. You know, part of this stress reduction and dealing with it, I needed in the military, and part of it, you know, I learned afterwards.
So, yeah, where's your mind at now then? It sounds like you're in a good space.
Much better space.
Yeah?
Yeah, but I think it's always a process.
And can you share a little bit? I mean, I think so many of us hear stories about those that serve, that the transition isn't so easy. I'm sure you have a handful of stories where you've, whether it being guys that you serve with or ones that you didn't know, I'm sure you're that guy that people reach out like, hey, I got a friend you got to talk to.
Yeah, definitely. And I was the one that thought I would have absolutely no issue with the transition, and me and my buddies were all operating fine.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I'd like to bring up is that the issues that you see with a lot of people, I don't believe are caused by military service. I think they're exacerbated. What I mean by that is my high-strung ways of always needing an adrenaline fix and go, 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 and always doing something was there before I joined the military. It was there when I was in middle school. A lot of people will tell you that. And I basically just found myself in a position within the military that encourages that. I was rewarded for it. I did really well. And so it was just kind of adding fuel to the fire, and these things being, you know, just always pedal to the floor mentally, compartmentalizing emotion, which is a really good skill to have in stressful situations, but can really hurt you on the back end.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, there is the physical damage to the brain from blast exposure. So that could be from heavy weapons, explosives, rockets.
So like TBI.
Okay. It's huge. And a lot of times we think about TBI as you have to get completely knocked out. The studies now show that you can have all of these micro TBIs, basically micro concussions.
And they're accumulative. They stack up like a...
They stack up, and what they're doing is they can be interrupting the neural connections in the brain. So guys are coming out with those issues, and those go basically completely untreated. And a lot of the studies that I did while I was in the military showed that the effects of those may not come out until 5, 10, 15 years down the line, which is why you hear a lot of these mental issues after military service. Mm-hmm. I reached out to a foundation called Warrior Angel Foundation that deals with this specifically while I was still in the military, saying, you know, myself and all of my buddies basically operate fine, but we're exposed to thousands of explosives on a daily basis. How can I protect myself? And that's where I got into the deeper research, mm-hmm. and we started taking some supplements for brain inflammation and things like that.
And within that regimen, were you ever exposed to, say, mushrooms and microdosing? And there's been a lot of studies with, you know,
I'm
not how into mycology you're into, but I mean, here in Laguna, mushrooms are pretty popular, just for the record. But no, but in terms of it's really interesting to see, you mentioned neurons and reconnecting those. It's exactly what you're talking about. There's been some promising studies with microdosing.
There's a ton on microdosing and larger doses as well, of all different psychedelics. You can look at MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. There's a couple of groups around here. There's a lot of veterans programs. I went through one called with Vet Solutions that helps guys get to, you know, treatments like that.
It's almost in some ways in one of the Journal of American Medicine pieces I wrote. It's a reset button for a lot of people.
Yeah,
which is a really amazing, hopeful thing.
I've never seen an effect from anything like psychedelics have done. We can go down that rabbit hole as well.
Oh, I go down that rabbit hole actually on a weekly basis.
Unfortunately, for the active guys, you know, they can't be engaging in those things,
right?
With drug tests and being operational.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a massive gap, and people are asking me all the time, "How do we help veterans? You know, coming out, can we give them jobs?" Which is fantastic. but we're missing an entire section from release from the military to mm-hmm. operating in normal society, which is how do we get your brain and your body functioning properly again to handle it. You have all these guys that are unbelievably high performers and would be great assets to society in any form, but in some way there's a piece that's broken, and that might, you know, a lot of it could be is typically through these brain injuries.
And I think we're at such on a precipice of such an exciting time that things are changing from THC to CBD to mushrooms. I think we're seeing it's a sea change of people realizing that this stuff works.
It's interesting. And it
versus pharma. Yeah, versus pharmaceuticals. I remember I had a skimboarding accident here in Laguna. I cut my liver in half skimboarding.
Wow.
Obviously it's recharged because I'm pounding beers right now. But I remember when they put me on Demerol, and I was 18 years old in the hospital, and I took care of the pain, but the glaze, I'll never forget that. Just that dirty feeling I have like coming down off the Demerol, and that's Demerol. We're not even talking like an oxy.
The opiate addiction is
a serious thing.
Serious. And the psychedelics are used a lot in the opiate addiction, but it's so interesting to see how we're almost going backwards and how a lot of this was, we're not backwards, but back in time.
Go to the source.
Yeah. It's utilized. There's a book called How to Change Your Mind, which goes through a lot of doctors who studied this in the 60s. Also, every... most Native American, or not Native American, Native cultures had some sort of warrior reintegration program, a lot of them utilizing psychedelics. And in some cases, when the men would come back from war, they were not even allowed back into society until they went through a certain process. Maybe they worked together on the land for a little bit, and then they reintegrated. My path was, my date came to an end, I signed some papers, I said I can't talk about certain things, and see you later, spit back out to the world. Is that necessarily wrong? No, but I kind of think it's up to us, as in, you know, other special operations veterans, to help build in that next step for guys.
Yeah, and this gets back to what we were talking about, it one size can't fit all, right? Yeah, it's coming up with a transition and a program and a place for people to find solace and that healthy transition. It's coming up with that is no easy task.
Yeah, and I think this transition we talk about goes for not only military, but you'll have it with athletes that come off a professional career. You can have it with people in business that come off a certain career. Mm-hmm. A lot of what we know as, jokingly, as the midlife crisis is typically like an identity crisis, which I think a lot of people go through. And it's all at different stages in life, and I see it with people of all ages now.
Yeah, I always say this too about, we're both fans of all things action sports, but like we as fans, we've been so spoiled when our heroes, come down with injuries. Like, I mean, these are injuries that should basically finish someone forever.
Yeah.
You know, the likes of Travis Pastrana, and you go down, you're just like, I go back to like, say the Condor, Matt Hoffman. I'm like, how many times can he replace his knee with a cadaver ligament? And, but they build themselves back up. I mean, they're all like, walking, talking, phoenixes everywhere. And it's, we take it for granted, but there's a lot of them that, they battle with the drugs, and they battle with the not being on top anymore. Like, that transition for them is really, it's hard.
And that transition has a lot to do with basically the suffering people feel when there's a big gap between their expectations and their current reality.
Yeah.
And that's with anything. And a lot of it is, who am I without these sports? And that was me when I came out too. Who am I if I'm not a Ranger? And that's something you have to figure out.
Okay, I love that you just said that. So then, what have you kind of through the rearview mirror, have you realized like what defines you? Like what defines a person?
Yeah, I think it's important to realize that what should define us is how we are as humans, how we're acting towards others in life and our projects, and not exactly what we're doing. If you put your worth in exactly what you're doing, if you put it in, I'm a sports announcer, I'm an athlete, I'm a lawyer, whatever, eventually you will lose that.
I could say that's what I do. That's not who I am, right?
Yeah.
There's a difference. I always had this.
A lot of people can't understand.
Yeah, well, I always had this thing too, and this is maybe getting into kind of like maybe like a Mean Girls high school sense of mind. No, but people would always ask me, "Hey, what do you think of so and so?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, I'm like, yeah, they're nice to me, but they're an asshole to everyone else." I'm like, "Yeah, I don't like him. I don't care that he's nice to me, and I don't even know what his motives are to be nice to me. But he's an asshole. Like, if it's how someone treats everyone." That's how I grade someone, not how they treat me, how they treat everyone.
And that could be a world-changing view.
Yeah.
Instead of
holding people accountable.
Instead of looking at people for, oh, this person's so great because they're successful at X, how they treat everybody. Right? And who you are as a person, you go through so many different stages of life. How could you ever define yourself as something you did for me with the military for such a short period of time in comparison to what my lifetime could be?
And so when was the last time you were in the so-called flow state? Was it on your ride down here, down the 405?
Oh, yeah. Especially once I got a little bit through the motorcycles.
I know what it is, but explain to people, listen, what is flow state?
So
why is it bitching?
Flow state, whether it's in the woo-woo sense of the term or actually, you know, chemically in the brain, is also what we could define as in the zone. Mm-hmm. So you could have this with an athlete. You could have this. They talk about people that code on computers being in that too. I forget what the term is. Where your brain is operating on a much higher level. You're comfortable. Things slow down. You sort of feel like Superman.
Mental matrix. Yeah.
Mental matrix. Right. Yeah. The brain is working better. The body is working better. You don't have to think. You're kind of just operating on muscle memory. Like the Matrix, right? And that's a mental state that we can all access, and people access it through different things. You see it with musicians and artists a ton too. For me, the best way has been through action sports, surfing, skiing, riding bikes, whatever it is.
So I want to give you the opportunity to, like, for those listening that want to kind of just A, follow you and B, kind of get involved. I know you talked about the coaching that you're doing. How do people reach out to you? And
They can reach out on Instagram if, you know, if people want to talk privately. It's Pierce.
You get some weird creepy DMs.
I get a lot of DMs.
Dane Cook does a good thing on creepy DMs.
But I also do this private coaching, and I'm about to launch a company called Built to Evolve, which is going to be utilizing sports and physical fitness, but injecting the mental side of it as well. And we'll be doing virtual and one-on-one mental coaching. So I'm hoping to be able to access everybody from, you know, pro athletes to, you know, stay-at-home mom, student, everybody.
Yeah, everyone's on their own level. I'd be remiss, too, if I didn't give you the opportunity. I know you're a fan of a lot of different sports, do a couple stand out? I mean, permission to have fanitude, but like, are there certain athletes where you're just, someone even such as yourself put you in awe?
Yeah. Most of them have been in sort of the action sports phase. One of them since I was young was Laird Hamilton.
Yeah.
You know, one, because there are so many people that can perform on an incredibly high level as he can, top of the sport. But not many of them completely take it into their own hands to learn all of the training side. So you'll see him in the pool doing the breath work.
And all the XPT work,
XPT, which I've had some friends go up and work with Laird in his pool, would love to at some point. You know, doing ice and heat and all this sort of mental exposure that he's utilizing the off season to create the best version of himself he can in the season. So I've really... He's an example of somebody that's been incredibly sort of experimental in that space.
Well, he's experimental in every component of his life. I've been lucky enough to know Laird. I met him through working with Gabby years ago, and then a couple years ago, went over to Kauai and thought I was killing it in the ice bucket. You know, like, you know, doing 3 minutes, but then like they, you know, they flip a fan on and then just like your nuts go up into your heart. You think, I mean, it's, but you go from the ice to the sauna, to the sauna, and it's all that, it's that fluctuation that teaches your body more resilience. But his openness, and his, that experimental, that Da Vinci of sorts, it's not just even with his training, but he pushed, you know, everything from toe-in to stand-up paddle to the foiling. Like, I remember years ago, he came on the Daily Habit and he was telling me about, you know, this early days where they had the K2 clicker boots on a foil, him and Titus. And those, I mean, that's a death sentence. When that thing sinks, like, you're going down in the drink. But he was trying to tell me, explain to me how, no. If you get a tightly packed wave, like a swell that's like tight intervals, you can ride from island to island on one wave. I'm like, wait, what? And that's when it started to like dawn on me. And I remember the first time I saw a foil, and it just defies logic because you're actually riding the energy moving under a wave, which actually is this big, versus when you surf, you're riding the gravity of the face of the wave. That's it. And so it's like for him to always think like that and not give two shits about what other people think. I mean, he does in some respects, but I really second your kind of assessment of him. He's definitely a pioneer and continues to be.
Yeah, foiling's the next thing I want to get into. But when you talk about the pioneers, he's somebody that pioneered a lot of these sports and foiling and towing, as well as, which I think is the most important part now, longevity. Right? Yeah. He's still one of the oldest guys doing these.
Yeah, inspirational for sure.
Absolutely.
He's got a couple years on you though.
Oh yeah,
and he's probably surfed a little bit bigger waves.
Many
anything on your initial like mini bucket list? I know you partake in a lot of stuff, but it could be Paris Dakar, could be an event, could be traveling somewhere. But what's on the?
We'll see. I'm trying to just kind of take advantage of a lot of the times that I lost out with being in the military. So. Skiing some powder. I just talked to a couple of buddies about heli skiing in Alaska, which would definitely be on the bucket list there. Going back and doing a big surf trip. I'd love to get back into body surfing the wedge on a 25-foot plus day, which I haven't done in a few years.
You have to do that. Come on.
That
doesn't go away. You're body womping until you'll be Mark Cunningham's age and still be killing it. Yeah.
What I really want to do is bring other people out to these sports that I think it can be really sort of healing for.
Yeah.
And I saw that when I took my buddy Dylan F on speed flying, and I went through the whole process of him of going through essentially an experience where he's staring the fear of death in the face, and the rush he and I both got of it of seeing his first flight was pretty incredible. And then just building communities, honestly, I'd love to get more people out there.
It's there's something so, I think it's triple the infection to have that vicarious experience when someone's doing it for the first time. Something that we don't say we take things for granted, but we definitely get slightly dull to certain things. So when you take people out, whether it be speed flying or you're doing their first tow-in session with them, or you're taking them to something that you've done a couple times and you know you were white knuckled the first time, but now you get to see it. So they're definitely that intoxicating aspect of vicariously sharing. And I'll leave it on this. I definitely put Alaska on the top of your list, especially the heli experience and being up there. It's big doesn't even begin to cover it. It's such a shifting baseline of what you think, you know, big is, what steep is. There's something to be said for AK.
I can't wait. That's absolutely on the bucket list. Okay.
We'll Pierce and then Kukizi.
Yep.
Look at that. Pierce Kukizi, former Army Ranger. Thank you so much for
appreciate it, man.
Yeah.
Thank you for
okay.
having me.